Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and last week we talked about Scorpions in the 70s with Fistful of Dave. This week we're going to cover Scorpions in the 80s with frequent guest and friend of the show, Joe Royland. Hey, Joe.
Hey, BJ. Thanks for having me back, man.
Thanks for coming back. Like I said to Dave last week, I'm trying to come up with excuses just to get you guys on the show.
Hey, worse for me.
Yeah.
I'm always excited to talk about great rock and roll, and today's band we're going to be talking about, no exception.
Yeah, one of the first bands that I got heavily into when I was like 12, or for some reason I connected with what was thought of as heavy metal music then. I mean, of course, yeah. Kiss, like for many people, were the gateway, but then...
Yep.
When I branched off, it was getting into like Dokken and Scorpions and Def Leppard, and that's just where it went for me. I don't really know why, you know, I don't know where that came from, but it's, you know, you can't really figure out why you like what you like. So they enter the 80s, and Matthias Jobs is the lead guitarist, and, you know, out of those 140 guitarists, like I said in the last episode, they sure made the right choice in my mind, because, I mean...
I agree, 100%. I'm like, you know, as great as Michael Schenker is, Matthias was absolutely the right choice for a guitar player for this band, especially for the 80s decade.
Yeah, I love his work. I think he's amazing. So yeah, the Love Drive tour was over a year long, and they did a lot of big festival dates and stuff like that, and it seems like they were getting really popular in Europe. And so I guess the Scorpions enter the 80s with their sights set on America, probably. And, you know, the new wave of British heavy metal has exploded, and Scorpions, I think, were hugely influential on that. Kind of pioneers when it comes to what turned into heavy metal out of the new wave of British heavy metal and everything. So so they enter the 80s, and, of course, at the same time, new wave is huge. And when you have new wave of British heavy metal and the huge popularity of new wave music happening at the same time, I think a lot of people didn't really know where things were going to go, and there were these different branches, and I don't think anybody could have anticipated how big heavy metal would get in the 80s, but, you know, the Scorpions were definitely honing their sound and kind of adapting and changing. Love Drive was definitely very transitional, and now that they got Matthias in the band, you know, they can go, because Uli was definitely... They were competing visions, I think, there. So once they somebody else, and then Matthias is more, he's just going to be a good guitar player for whatever they want to do, I think, and not really, I don't know if Matthias, you know, I think he's just, you know, did what the band needed, whereas Uli had his own vision and his own thing that he wanted to do, which of course is why he left. So Animal Magnetism, their first album in the 80s, comes out in March. And they've got another Hypnosis album cover. And like Dave said, he thinks it's their most offensive. Well, God, well, Virgin Killer obviously is more offensive than almost anything. But we were talking about how Love Drive, I mean, it's just funny. Dude, why is that offensive? But Animal Magnetism, especially the juxtaposition of the dog on the back cover, is kind of a troubling imagery.
It is. It's funny because you read the quote from, I think it was Francois Bulls, who said, I don't understand the cover. I don't know why people had a problem with it, but I like the dog.
You know? Yeah, like... that's the worst part. Well, there definitely seems to be, obviously there are things that are implied by the positioning and of the people and everything like that. So
right, and they clearly inspired a joke in Spinal Tap too, where they had the Smell the Glove album. Right. You know,
yeah. But you know, Hypnosis, I guess maybe they thought it was funny. I don't really see how it's very funny, but Love Drive is funny. The Love Drive cover is funny, but Animal Magnetism, not so much.
No.
But in my opinion, this is a much better album than Love Drive. Yeah, I said that Love Drive is one of my least favorite of the... Maybe... I said it was my least favorite of the Dieter Dierks albums, but then Dave's like, well, what about Savage Amusement? And then I was like, oh yeah, he produced that.
Yeah.
Animal Magnetism is a great album, like really cohesive and really tight and... you know, like a unified sound, not a competition between styles and stuff like that. So they're definitely on the right track, I think, with that record.
What's interesting to me is, like, I came into the Scorpions with Love Drive, but by that point, it had already been out for a while, and Animal Magnetism had been out for a while too. And so I actually thought Animal Magnetism was the album that came out before Love Drive for a long time, before I you know, this is when I was first learning a lot about rock music and stuff. Right. And I, so I always used to think it was the album before it. And to me, it still has very much of a 70s feel to it compared to Love Drive, which to me, Love Drive, where it came out in 79, sounds like the beginning of the 80s. But Animal Magnetism, in a way, almost feels like a step back in the way that it just has more of that 70s feel to it, to me at least, than Love Drive does.
I could see what you're saying. I think Love Drive has a certain kind of production that is leaning more towards metal, and Animal Magnetism, yeah, is not really heavy metal production at all.
But no, it's more hard rock production. You know?
I think it's way better. I think the production of Animal Magnetism is way better, in my opinion, than Love Drive. I do see what you're saying with some of the styles on Animal Magnetism harken back more to the pre-Love Drive albums.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I see that.
You can hear things that sound like In Trance but, you know, I think they were purposely trying to go with, like you were saying about, like, the dawn of new wave and stuff in the 80s coming on, and they were trying to try out new sounds on Love Drive, and it didn't always work out for them. And like you said, it's kind of all over the place. You've got songs like Is There Anybody There, which is like heavy metal reggae.
Yeah.
And things like that, but you're right in that Animal Magnetism is much more cohesive in its sound.
Yeah, and Animal Magnetism is just a lot cleaner and like radio ready sound.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
More, it feels more professional, like very focused, I guess.
Yeah, yes, exactly. It's got a much more consistent, focused production tone to it.
And the mix on Love Drive was just like loud, heavy guitar, like the vocals kind of buried. But they're definitely, you know, you could see that they're, now they want to conquer America, and they play, well, they did the Monsters of Rock in August of 1980 with Riot, Saxon, Priest, and Rainbow, so that was pretty huge. But this one, they do their first U.S. tours, I guess, for Animal Magnetism. I think that's what it says in the Martin pop-up book. That's surprising, but they opened for Nugent, and they opened for AC/DC on the Animal Magnetism tour. The record wasn't a huge hit. I think it made it to 52 on Billboard and didn't really have a single that did anything on the charts, I don't think.
There were like at least one track that got a lot of radio play.
Oh yeah, well yeah, there's songs that got a lot of radio play later, but I don't think they really, you know, did much action at the time when they were new. I think it was more after the band got bigger with the next couple albums that then they started. I don't know if I'm right about that, but
yeah, because that's the way it seemed to me. I mean, there was, like, you would hear The Zoo off of Animal Magnetism on radio, but usually it would be the kind of song you would only hear, like, on the overnights on radio.
Yeah.
It wasn't something they played during the prime drive, but with the band's next record, that's when you would finally start to hear the songs in prime time, and, you know, would see the video on MTV, and you realize, okay, this is a band that's transitioning from being kind of on the fringe to being right in the middle, you know, the mainstream sound.
So I guess Animal Magnetism didn't really, probably didn't match what their hopes were for it. They did finally get the tour in the U.S. at least and get that kind of exposure. And I guess getting to 52 on Billboard in 1980, you know, that's pretty good. That's a step in the right direction. So
you're in the top 100, so.
Yeah. But then what happens is Klaus loses his voice. I guess too much touring without warming up or taking care of his voice adequately and putting a lot of strain on it. And he lost it completely and needed to have surgery even. And then so there's all these multiple stories about Don Dokken being brought in to sing on demos or even possibly sing on what might have been the record. I've even seen talk that they were thinking about he might need to replace Klaus in the band. And, you know, he had been over in Germany. Well, as George Lynch told me, Don Dokken took the Exciter demo over to Germany and got a record deal with their songs, but under his name.
Yeah.
And that's why the band was called Dokken, because even though Don Dokken joined Exciter, there was a coup there where he got the record deal himself. That's what George Lynch told me. You know, who knows what to believe between these guys?
I tend to believe George.
Yeah. So Don went like over to Germany and got a record deal and met Michael Wagner. I guess that's how he's brought into this. He was just over there and meeting people, and he ends up singing on Blackout, like kind of in Klaus's place as they're preparing to make the record, you know? And I've seen an interview where Don Dockett says you can still hear him on some of the really high parts on the record.
Yeah.
Which I don't know about that. One thing I do know is that nothing with Don Dockin has ever been out there in bootlegs or on YouTube or anything,
right,
to hear Don Dockin singing any of these songs. So it's hard to really know what went on. But
yeah, it's kind of like, you know, the Scorpions, even if they have that, they don't want that getting out. So.
Yeah, right. But, you know, stuff, I mean, these days it's like there's very few things that you haven't heard, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it took more than a year for this album to be finished, mainly because of Klaus's vocal problems, and that they had an entire year there where they didn't tour at all. So they must have been feeling like, you know, pretty antsy to get the show back on the road. So Blackout was released in March of 82, so that's exactly 2 years after Animal Magnetism. And, you know, I would have thought No One Like You was a bigger hit, because I always thought that was like their breakthrough song.
Yeah, and it pretty much it was.
Yeah, it was. It like, was, but like it only made it to 65 on the charts.
And it's surprising.
Yeah,
but you got to consider that it's the pop charts. So
true.
But I mean, yeah, that video was all over early MTV, and like even before, like I didn't even get MTV in my neighborhood until 2 years later. But you had things like Radio 1990 and. Where they would play the videos and stuff, all that, and Friday night videos where you would see things like that. But that was the first time I remember hearing a song on, like I said, daytime radio in the prime drive, as opposed to like, oh, I'm only hearing the song on the overnights. So right. That's how I knew, oh, this is a band that they're finally coming into the spotlight.
Yeah, I've had that experience a lot with researching stuff where a song that I thought was a much bigger hit because MTV played it so much, and then you find out, oh, that wasn't even that big of a hit, but you just got the impression that it was through, like, the radio and MTV and things. But No One Like You was the, I guess, I mean, I've always thought it was their breakthrough in the U.S., you know, like the first, and the album did hit 10, get to number 10 on Billboard, and it must have been driven in part by that.
You Give Me All I Need got a pretty amount of, a decent amount of play, too, at least up here it did.
Really? Okay. I don't really remember hearing that on the radio much, but this is there's a big difference between Blackout and Animal Magnetism, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I guess Blackout is much more 80s heavy metal sound. But 82 is before there was really a lot of breakout success with that kind of stuff yet, so you know, it's not like they were trying to jump on the Quiet Riot bandwagon or anything like that yet. May 1983, they played the US Festival. That was a big deal at the time, I think. So they were getting exposure from that probably, too.
Yeah. There were a lot of bands that got a lot of up-and-coming bands at the time that got a lot of exposure out of the US Festival that kind of really broke them. Not even like metal, but like U2, not even a metal band, but that really helped break them. And
Motley Crue and Quiet Riot were both on that bill,
yes,
weren't they?
Yeah. Them too, yeah. So a lot of those bands that played that was a big deal because it got broadcast and on TV and on the radio, so that helped really put these bands more in the forefront.
So, okay, Metal Health came out in 83, right? It must have, right? It's not 82.
Yes, yeah, 1983.
So fall, that's interesting that...
Or summer.
Yeah, this is interesting. I haven't thought about this, but so Blackout's March of 82, and by about a year later... Motley Crue and Quiet Riot are on the US Festival, so in the first year of Blackout is when that kind of music became much more popular, you know?
Right.
So their timing was pretty good here.
Yep.
And I guess the success of bands like Quiet Riot and Twisted Sister must have helped, you know? So not only did they set the stage for their next album, like with No One Like You and hitting number 10 on Billboard, playing the US Festival... This kind of music starts to get more popular with other bands, And so they're really kind of primed for their next album to be successful, and of course it is. Love at First Sting, it comes out in March 84, so this is another 2 years between records. Blackout is certified platinum in 84, too. And Love at First Sting is platinum by the end of the year. So probably the success of Love at First Sting kind of spurred the sales of Blackout and even the previous albums. And now they have a big hit single from this record, too, with Rock You Like a Hurricane. Yeah, all over MTV. And Love at First Sting, they definitely, the pop metal sound, you know, is locked in on that record. It kind of, to me, it feels a little bit dumbed down, Love at First Sting. You know, not as strong creatively as the previous records. You know what I mean?
It's, well, yeah, it's definitely got a commercial formula to it. You know, I think there was a concerted effort to break through to the mainstream and say, like, I think you're right, what you were talking about with the last album. They knew they had an inroad with the last record, and they're like, let's just come in and crack it with this album and just hit them head on. And you can hear it in the songs, like, and even in the videos and the look that they had sort of changed. And I mean, how many songs were at least four, if not five, videos from this album that were all over MTV from like 1984 through 85 and into 86. So
right, yeah,
you know, and it's
this is when the radio play exploded for the band too. Definitely.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, and it was a big album for me. Like, that was the year I graduated high school. It came out just before I graduated high school, so these songs were getting a lot of play. We listened to it all summer. That was the first big concert I saw after, like, probably the week after I graduated, was the Scorpions and Bon Jovi, like, who no one had heard of then. It opened for them, and it was, oh, it's just a killer, killer live show. I actually met the band after the show, like, hanging out by the buses, because that's what you did then when you were a young kid. And Klaus Meine, this is an interesting story. We were like waiting for them all to come out. We're just like saying hi to them as they come out. And Klaus was the last one to come out. And I still remember this because it was so weird. He just comes up to me, grabs both my hands in his hand, and just starts spouting all this stuff in German that I barely understood any of. Like, I was actually born in Germany, but being an Air Force brat, but he's just like, and he's just going on and on for like 10 minutes saying all this stuff and like holding my hands and shaking my hands in his hands, and then like finally lets go and like waves his arms and gets on the bus, and everybody turns and looks at me like, what was that all about? I'm like, I have no idea, but it was cool. You know, so that was like one of my first big moments, like, I have no idea what just happened, but that was really cool.
Are you sure he was speaking German, or was it just English that you couldn't understand?
No, I probably would have been able to understand it. It was definitely German, but it was just like,
really? Why was he speaking German? Did he think you were someone else or something?
I don't know, and I just thought maybe he knew I was born there or something. I don't know. It's just so weird. Like, how would he know that? But it was just bizarre. But I've always remembered that moment because it was just so weird.
I mean, it sounds like you're describing one of his stage raps. Like,
yeah.
The first time I saw them, my friend Dan's dad took us, and I remember every time Klaus would talk between songs, he was just cracking up because Klaus would just go, you know, yeah. Even though a single word he said, like, it would be like a stream of that and then Milwaukee at the end. You know, you would understand Milwaukee, but that was it.
I think there may have been like a thank you at the end, and that was about in English and stuff, but it was just so bizarre.
Well, it must have been such an exciting time for them, because that's when they were really exploding, when they were on that tour probably, so they must have been flipping out, you know?
Yeah.
After all those years, after how long they'd been at it, this is 12, 13 years after Klaus joined the band, and they're finally breaking really big, so... and then they cash in, they release the live album in June of 85, and that even goes platinum, which shows you the way the record industry was back then.
Yeah.
You know, I love how they could just repackage the same songs a year later and sell them again. They were in heaven back then with record sales. Even though they had this huge success, it seems like they had a lot of issues when it came to following up that record.
Oh yeah. 4 years for this year.
I don't really know a lot of stories about what was going on, but probably different members wanted to go in different directions. I mean, you could kind of hear the conflict in the record that eventually comes out. Like, it, they definitely doubled down on a certain style, which was probably a mistake in retrospect. I know I loved that record at the time when it came out.
Me too. I used to almost listen to it like every night, like before I would go to sleep, I would always just throw some album on to listen to. And that was one for quite a few months, was Savage Abusement.
I still like it, but it doesn't hold up as well as you might.
Exactly.
Think. Yeah. And it when definitely, you could, in retrospect, you could see that, especially with the production, they made some mistakes. But at the time, you know, that's it sounded like everything else pretty much. So,
like, they really bought into what was going on, and especially like how a lot of the metal bands did, just got really poppy. Priest got poppy, Ozzy got poppy, Def Leppard got really poppy, you know, and the Scorpions just kind of went right along with it too, you know. Even like the clothes that they were wearing at the time, you know, they were like costumes more than just stage clothes, and it was just everything, the productions of the show. I remember I saw them live on that tour too, and it was so different from 4 years earlier and seeing them on Love at First Sting. It was just really glammed up. And
that's crazy how, if you think about, like, even how much money they left on the table. They could have put out a record in 86 and sold a lot of copies. Then in 87 it sold a lot of copies, and, you know, and it seems like they did so much obsessing and tinkering over this record, and when, you know, just make another Scorpions record and put it out, you know, every year, and, you know, you probably go platinum.
That's why I think, like, Worldwide Live was just a stopgap measure. It's like, we gotta capitalize on this, but we don't have anything ready, so let's just throw out this live album.
Yeah. Well, they had taken 2 years, you know, between their previous couple albums too, but to go 4 years after you have a big breakthrough, especially in the 80s, is pretty crazy. I mean, I guess that's the Def Leppard model.
Yeah.
So I don't know if, like, Dave, obviously, I had no love for Savage Abusement. I don't know how a lot of Scorpions fans feel about it. You know, it was the first, for me, it was the first new Scorpions album after I became a fan. So I remember Rhythm of Love came out on MTV, and I liked it, and I got the record, and pretty much liked it all the way through. Probably the worst songs on this record are the heavy, fast ones.
Yeah. So
those are the worst ones, probably. Like, what's it called? You Let It Rock, We Let It Roll, or whatever.
Yeah.
That's probably, like, the worst song on the record, and that's the one that's, like, Dynamite style or something, you know?
Yeah. It got a little too formulaic.
Yeah. But there's a lot, there's, you know, just really, like, poppy songs like Media Overkill and Walking on the Edge and
Passion Rules the Game.
Yeah, that's another one. Passion Rules the Game is another song that I thought was a much bigger hit than it was. Like, MTV played that constantly, but it barely even charted, I think.
Oh, and Believe in Love, too. The big ballad.
Yeah, that was the big ballad. Did you know that song goes all the way back to, like, In Trance?
Yeah.
There's a version of it on YouTube. I didn't know that. That's just kind of a rewrite of an old song. I had no idea. So that's their last album of the 80s. Savage Abusement. Well, it made it to number 5 on Billboard, and it went platinum. And like I said, they were all over MTV.
Yeah.
With those videos. From my memory, Passion Rules the Game was played the most. I think Rhythm of Love and Believe in Love were both before that video. But I remember Passion Rules the Game being on a lot. So yeah, there's not much muscle. That album is so polished and, like I said, tinkered with. It does have a lot of Hysteria feel to it, I think.
Yep.
So, well, and Dave was wondering on the last episode about how much Dieter was influenced by Mutt Lange. Like, he thinks that Dieter was kind of following Mutt Lange's lead on some of this stuff.
I would agree with that. That sounds right.
Yeah. And this is the last album they make with Dieter, too, so it's definitely, it's very much the end of an era. I would say the next album they're going to come out with, to me, I went back and listened to it recently, and I thought it was really bad.
That's why I stepped off.
I don't remember being much of a fan of it when it came out, but listening to it now, the songs are just not good at all.
No. that was where I stepped off. Yeah, I was like, for a while.
That record was huge.
Yeah. So that goddamn whistling, man. If I never hear that song again, it'll be too soon.
Yeah, I think I was... I think they were talking about it on the Rock and Metal Combat page or something, and something about what's your favorite song in Crazy World, and I went... And I couldn't even figure out what my favorite song on there is, because there isn't even one song that I even like that much, which is crazy. You know? It's just really weak. Like all the songs are just mediocre, and nothing really stands out from it. So I don't know how much that has had to do with not working with Dieter anymore, or I don't know what was going on with that, but it didn't matter because it was huge. They mainly because of that one massive single they had, but that came out in 1990, so that's without Dieter, and that's pretty much the end. I mean, then grunge is going to hit, and then I think Face the Heat is way better than Crazy World, but by that time nobody cared
so exactly.
It's all over then. All right, so do you think we're ready to count down our top 10 songs of the 80s?
I think so. Mine's an interesting list, so.
All right, you want to start with your number 10?
Number 10, it's the only song I have off of Savage Amusement. And not really one of the hits, although I seem to remember getting some sort of airplay or video airplay, but it's Every Minute, Every Day. I had to throw a bone or something on that album. That's like the one song I just still like off that record. It's just got a cool guitar riff to it, and it's just a decent rock song. So I had to throw that record around, but I like that tune. Still like that song. When I went back and listened to the album, like you, I thought it didn't hold up, but that was the one song that I said, I still like this song. So that's my number 10.
Yeah, I like that song. Yeah, I get the record doesn't hold up in terms of... It's good, but it should have been better, I think. Would be what I would say. So now when you listen to it, you just kind of hear the missteps.
And right.
Like, you're kind of like, oh, this could have been so much better. But...
Yeah.
Yeah, well, my number 10 is also from Savage Amusement, but it's the first single, Rhythm of Love, which I've always liked this song a lot. I like the vibe of it and the arrangement, and I think the melodies are great. And it was a cool video. They were like on a spaceship, I remember. I could have put numerous different songs at number 10, and I wasn't really sure about putting this in here or not, but I have always liked it quite a bit, so it made the cut. So number 10, Rhythm of Love.
Yeah. It was a toss-up between those two songs for me, believe it or not. But I just kind of, as I did with like a lot of my songs, I kind of avoided the hits just because I'm just tired of hearing them. They got so played out that I just, I'd rather feature some of the songs that weren't hits and that maybe people aren't as familiar with. So that's why I went with Every Minute, Every Day over Rhythm of Love. But I do like that song, too.
It's funny, though. It's a song where if somebody said, I don't like that, I'd be like, yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't argue the point, but I like it.
Together, one night we never do. It's blue.
My number nine comes from the Love at First Sting album. The Scorpions would do a lot of songs about being on the road or playing concerts in front of people. And this is one of those songs. But it's the song Coming Home. And I love how the song has the fake intro where you think you're going to be hearing a ballad. And then it kind of transitions in on... it could be Rudolph or it could be Matthias, I'm not sure, but the guitar is just kind of playing this little solo thing, and it kind of builds in volume from the background up and then just kicks onto this full-on assaulting rocker. That was a song they would use to open a lot of the tour dates on Love at First Sting, and I think it's like the first, there's like a little intro, but then it's the first song on the Worldwide Live album. And I just, out of all those type of songs, that's one of my favorites by them for that genre.
Dream, we're going out on stage. It feels like coming home again. Dream, we're going out on stage. It feels like.
Well, my number nine is also from Love at First Sting. It's the ominous, at the time, opening track, Bad Boys Running Wild, which it's funny how stuff that maybe seemed ominous in the 80s now is kind of humorous. But This was a heavy song at the time, but it's also really poppy. Klaus is great on the song. I love the melody on the verse more than the chorus.
That's actually my number six song.
Okay.
But I love that opening guitar riff, that spiraling, cascading intro. It actually is in stereo, too, panned in stereo. And I remember when I first put on the album, you hear that, it's like, what is this? It was just kind of mind-blowingly cool. But yeah, I agree with you, like, about the chorus parts and stuff. And you were like, when you actually go back and read the lyrics to what he's saying, you're like, what the hell is he on about here? Yeah. It just sounds so ridiculous, but at the time, it's still cool. Like, where I get what you're talking about, or it's kind of funny, but it's still cool.
Yeah, at this point, it's kind of ridiculous, like, if you listen to it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, boys running wild. It's just stupid. But it's
fun.
Yeah, it is. It's a good song. And the verse, the melody on the verse is great. Probably even be better if it wasn't so stupid.
but you know that if you were at a Scorpion show and that song came on, you'd be totally into it.
I'd love it. Yeah.
My number eight, I'm going to Love It First Thing. I'm probably going to go there a few more times on this album, but it's just, to me, it was such a big album just because of when it came out and just the nostalgia and the memories for that album for me. But not a hit, really, or not one of the bigger songs out of the album, but the song As Soon As the Good Times Roll. I just like the atmosphere of the song, and again, it's just kind of a more of a mid-tempo number, but I like the playing in it, the little guitar pits, and how it switches back and forth between being kind of one sounding song to a different sounding song. I like Klaus's vocals in it a lot. That's my number eight, As Soon As the Good Times Roll.
Yeah, I think there's a few songs on Love It First Thing that are a different style of song that they kind of adapted to the kind of record it was. And so there's a coolness to it because it's kind of weird. It's like they took this song and made it a heavy metal song, even though it's not, kind of thing.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
long time apart, but it's you that I love, don't you see? And when I go away, you say please stay okay. I want you to stay only with me.
Okay, my number 8 is from Animal Magnetism. A weird song with a very catchy chorus. It's called Only a Man. And the verse is odd, but the weirdness of the verse creates an awesome hook when the chorus kicks in. So I've always been a big fan of that song. And I love the strangeness of it. I think this is one of the songs in Animal Magnetism that, like you were saying, harkens back to their 70s albums.
Funny, because my next one comes from Animal Magnetism as well, and the ballad Lady Starlight. It just definitely feels like an older school 70s type of rock song for ballad. Great guitar solo in it. We kind of influenced some of their ballads to come, but it really has more of an old school feel to it. And it's just, it almost sounds like it could have come off of In Trance, but I still dig it.
I always liked their ballads in the 70s. I didn't really like their ballads when they went for, like, power. I never liked Still Loving You, personally. But but their 70s ballads were usually good, and yeah, you're right. I had, you know, like, your point about Animal Magnetism sounding more like their 70s stuff is right on, and I hadn't even really, like, thought about it or noticed it before. Like I want love. Number 7. My number 7 is incredibly poppy song from Love at First Sting called I'm Leaving You, with just great melodic guitar, crazy catchy melody. You know, it's just a pop song. Like we're saying, it's a complete pop song, kind of made into a heavy metal song to fit the style of the record. But
yeah,
I love it.
I'm on board with that one as well. It's it'll show up later in my list. I'll talk more about it then. So
okay. I can't.
And we already got to my number six, which is Bad Boys Running Wild. So what is your number six?
My number six is, this is one where I really had to struggle. Like we were talking about trying to be objective and remembering how I felt about the song before I heard it for the 10 millionth time. So my number six is the band's like breakout song in America, No One Like You, which I know I loved. I know it's one of the first Scorpion songs I heard, and I know I loved this song at one point in my life. I don't ever want to hear it again. But so I tried to figure out where it should go in my list, even though I wouldn't have put it on my list if I was just talking about what are my favorite Scorpion songs to listen to right now. But I kind of tried to be fair about it and say, you know, just as quality of song and how much I liked it at one point, I should put this song on the list. So
yeah.
No One Like You made it, but I don't want to listen to it. You know,
that's funny because it's my number five. and for the same reason. It's just like it's a big breakout success. There are elements of the song I really like. I like when it become like when you get the dueling lead guitar or the twin lead guitars. I'd say it's not so much dueling, but they're kind of playing the same riff. It's funny because when we were talking about how Don Dokken had come in as the guide vocalist for some of the songs, to me this song is a mold for a lot of Dokken songs to come. You could just hear like sort of a Dokken formula, like whether he got that from them or that's the way I'd read it. But I just hear a lot of a Dokken style in the way Dokken songs are constructed in that song, especially going back and re-listening to it again. But yeah, it's just kind of like I heard it so much that it's hard to listen to it now. But as opposed to say another big song that I would just come out and say right now, it's not on my list, Rock You Like a Hurricane. I can at least still listen to No One Like You, is like, whereas like Rock You Like a Hurricane, it's like one of the first songs I learned to play on guitar. I've just heard it too much. Even though some people are going to be like, what, that's not on your list, I couldn't include it because I'm just so tired of hearing it. So my number five was No One Like You by The Scorpions.
But my number five is first song, side two of Blackout, fast-paced, great guitar work, great chorus, Dynamite. I love the way that record opens each side with like a really balls-to-the-wall song, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, Dynamite it's just drums and vocals on the verse, and then the way the chorus just kicks in with the riff. The riff is awesome. A riff probably makes the song even. But yeah, I love that song.
Oh yeah, I can't argue with that. I almost made my list, but didn't quite make it. That would bring us to my number four song, which was I'm Leaving You.
Yeah,
off right. of Vesta. Yeah. I just, like you said, I love the melody in that. Again, I like that there's the switch up when it gets to the bridge parts. That was something I really found interesting about a lot of the songs on that album, how like they would start one way and then switch over to this other sound. It was never really a hit for the band, although they did have a video for it, but that's one of my favorite songs by the band, especially from that record, is I'm Leaving You. So that's my number four.
Okay, my number four is the opening track from Savage Amusement, which I love, Don't Stop at the Top. I think it's such a well-crafted song with great hooks. The bridge and the chorus, I think, are really great. So I love that song.
Yeah, that is a good one. I had too many other songs from too many other albums, so something had to give. And it was, unfortunately, it was songs from that record.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, obviously. I mean, I think it's fucking great. So it's way better than anything else on that album. So
they always had, Scorpions always had really killer opening album tracks.
Yeah.
And that's definitely one of them.
Yeah.
I cannot argue with that.
Yeah, looking here, two of my top three are opening tracks.
I guess that brings me to number three, and my number three, not an opening track, but it felt like it could have been one, and it's off of Blackout is Can't Live Without You. I love a song with a good count-in intro, which this one has, and the guitar riff is just great. It's fun. It's just a good upbeat, fun song. Not as full-on rocking as Blackout, which, again, almost made my list. It was kind of a tough choice between these two songs, but ultimately I had to go with Can't Live Without You instead because I just like the song more. It's a little poppier, but I like it more.
Interesting. I don't really like that one. I don't like that chorus. That song never really connected with me at all.
I think probably my favorite thing of the song is the intro, the count-in intro. I like songs with a good count-in intro, and just the way they do it, it's really good.
Well, my top three is pretty much a tie for number one. Like, I had a hard time ranking these last three because I pretty much love all of them equally. So I kind of eventually put them in an order, but it's almost like a three-way tie.
Yeah, interesting.
At number three for me, so much nostalgia. And like we were talking about, No One Like You, I'm just so sick of. I don't think I would ever be sick of this song. Big City Nights from Love at First Sting. I just love it. And I don't think, like I said, I couldn't be sick of it. Even I've heard it so many times, I'm not sick of it at all. I love it every time I hear it.
It's a great song, but again, it's like I had to not include every song from Love at First Sting. Unfortunately, that was one of the ones that was like, oh, it almost made it, but not quite. But I do love that tune too. It's great. Just a fun chorus, and we, of course, like, you know how you would like sometimes make up stupid lyrics to go to hit songs. That was one of them that was an easy one to do, but I won't say what it was we made up to it. But you could probably figure it out. You know?
Well, I could tell you, my brother is Timmy, and we used to sing Big Timmy Stinks. Timmy. Big Timmy Stinks. That'd be my friends would sing to him. Being assholes. So yeah, we had, but yeah, I can imagine what you're talking about.
Yeah. It
rhymes with city.
Yes, exactly. My number two, of course, is going to come off Love at First Sting, and I know you're not a big fan of it, but this is one of those songs that I don't get tired of hearing, which is Still Loving You. Quintessential power ballad. I love all the different guitar parts that are going on in the song and the way they fade in and out, the way the song just builds. Klaus's vocal performance, it's a song that you like. I can go a while without hearing it, but then when I go back and listen to it, I just get into it and I'm just singing along to it and cranking it up at full volume. But I still love that song. So my number two is Still Loving You, even though I know you're not a fan.
Yeah, I never liked that song, and it's not because it's a ballad, it's just I think it's really boring. Just, you know, my personal taste or whatever.
But yeah, I know how you feel about like classic. I know how you feel about classic, like bluesy kind of numbers and stuff like that.
Yeah. Craig Smith won't let up about Me and I Still Love You by Kid.
I know he had a good rib at you and one of the 12 Days of Christmas this week about that.
Yeah. And he said, Babe, I'm gonna leave you. And then I wrote to him and said, I like Babe, I'm gonna leave you. And he's like, oh yeah, I meant to say. Since I've been loving you, because that's the Zeppelin song that I talk shit about, and and then I wrote to him, yeah, but you did nail my voice.
Oh, I don't want to hear that. I'm BJ Cramp. I'm not coming to the Last Kiss show if they're gonna play that song. I don't like it. That's the Babe I'm Gonna Leave You of the Kiss catalog.
But speaking of Pods and Sods, they did an episode about Love at First Sting with the guys from Shabby Road, and I remember all four of those guys just talked about Still Loving You as if it was the greatest piece of work ever to exist. And then I think I wrote to them and said, you know, I don't like that song. And then Craig Smith probably called me a dick or was one of his catchphrases. Vile. He probably wrote vile back to me when I said that. But yeah, I just think it's a bore. It's a thing they used to play it constantly on the radio, and it's just like, oh my god, is this going to be older soon?
I get that from your point of view, but
yeah. Well, my number two is the opposite of Still Loving You. It's Blackout.
Yeah.
The title track from Blackout, which some of my favorite guitar work ever on this song by Matthias Jobs, especially if you're listening to it with headphones. I think Matthias is in the right ear.
Mm-hmm.
And the tone of his guitar, I fucking love it so much. He just does all these licks. Don't want to find out. My favorite thing about the song is Matthias's guitar licks on the verses, and then the riff on the chorus. So really, the best stuff about the song is the guitar work, I think. The verse melody is great, but those guitar licks and then that riff on the verse, I just love the song so much.
So my number one, can't go wrong with it. Classic rock riff, still holds up to this day. Again, like one of those first songs I was learning to play on guitar. It's The Zoo from Animal Magnetism. If there's a quintessential Scorpion song to me, this is it. I don't know if it's your number one, but it's mine.
No, it's not.
But, you know, I like the talk, as far as songs with talk boxes in it, you know, that's got one in it. But I that still my favorite Scorpion song to this day is The Zoo. I love how Klaus's vocal lines in it. I just love everything about that song.
Well, The Zoo is one of those songs I used to like, but I'm just, I was made so sick of it by the radio. In Milwaukee, the radio, that might have been, I would bet that was the most played Scorpion song on Milwaukee radio, was The Zoo. After Love at First Sting. Like, after they went back and started playing, like, all the old hits. So maybe, like, 86-ish or something. That's when I was 12. That's when I probably was first listening to it. And from 86 to, like, 1990 or whenever I would listen to the radio, I bet that was the song they played the most by the Scorpions, was that.
See, to me, that's, like, one of the ones where I would only hear it usually on late-night radio. It would be rarity if you ever heard it daytime. But I would always, like, catch it. I did a lot of late-night radio listening back then, and so I would always catch it then and think, wow, what a great tune this is. I've just never gotten sick of it.
Yeah, but the Milwaukee radio stations would just pick these songs that they would just play incessantly. Are we gonna do? It's walking around to catch the thrill on streets we call the zoo. We eat the night, we break the time, make our dreams come true. And hungry eyes are passing by on streets we call.
And hungry eyes are passing.
All right, well, my number one, the first song on Animal Magnetism, Make It Real. I just love it so much. Such a well-written song. Pop metal perfection is what I wrote. So catchy. The hook on the chorus is amazing. It's just great songwriting, in my opinion. So Make It Real. Should have been a huge hit. I love it. So how many, what did we match, like two or three?
I think five.
Oh, was it that many?
Let's see. Well, we had No One Like You, I'm Leaving You. Oh, no, maybe it was three.
Oh, Bad Boys Run Wild.
Bad Boys Run Wild, yep.
Oh, so three.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Seemed like it was more than that for some reason.
But I think it was because I beat you to the punch on all three of them.
That's true, yeah. So, that might be it.
Yeah. All right, so Scorpions in the 80s. I loved it in the 80s. They were one of my favorite bands. Yeah, and I still listen to them all the time. But yeah, past the 80s, I don't ever listen to anything they did. But
yeah, not much, no. Maybe every now and then I'll take something out as a curiosity and like play something off of Eye to Eye and go, what were they thinking? But that's about it.
That's the one where it's just the three guys on the cover, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess they didn't have any, over the course of the 80s, they had no lineup change. That's interesting.
No.
That's pretty cool. They maintained that lineup all through the 80s. I think Francis Buchholz left after Crazy World, right? I don't think he's on.
I think so, yeah. Really
Face the Heat, I don't think he's on.
But I think they just, they had that whole if it isn't broke, don't fix it mentality going through. Same producer, same band members, you know, they just, this is working, let's keep it rolling. Yeah. Until it didn't.
Well, something wasn't working between Love at First Thing and Savage Amusement. I'm not sure what it was, but there must have been issues or problems. There must have been something going on, which I think we don't know because nobody really cares about Savage Amusement, so there's never really been any kind of journalistic discussion of it. But something must have gone down. There must have been issues there for it to take that long.
True.
But I have no idea what...
It could have been more issues with Klaus's voice that we never heard about because...
Yeah, that's possible. Very possible.
They did a lot of touring behind Love at First Sting, so...
Yeah, that when people blow out their voice like that, I'm not really sure how that happens. I mean, it happened to Jon Bon Jovi. It happened to Tom Kiefer. I guess if they don't sing the right way and put too much strain on it, then it gives out at some point. I mean, Jon Bon Jovi's never been the same after the New Jersey tour. I guess singing Living on a Prayer, when it goes up a key, he just destroyed his voice, I think.
Yeah.
When did they invent that fucking acoustic version that they always do now so he doesn't have to sing it? That was after the New Jersey tour, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so horrible. That horrible acoustic version they do. And it's so transparent that they just do it that way because he can't sing
it. You sing it.
Yeah, right. He had to like relearn how to sing. I mean, you could tell that Jon Bon Jovi just like figured out a different way to sing because he couldn't sing the other way anymore. And they were on Howard Stern last year and oh my God, it was horrible.
Because
he just doesn't even... sing. He does this fake weird thing.
Sing speak.
Yeah, it's awful.
But that's another band or another time.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know. Is there anything else we should? I guess we didn't talk about Best of Rockers and Ballads.
Oh yeah.
When
geez.
Did that come out? Was that between Savage and
what? 89 or 90?
Somewhere. I think it was between them. I loved Hey You when that came out.
Yes.
What was that recorded for Love Drive, I think?
I think it was.
Yeah.
It had to be either 89 or 90 for that record.
Yeah.
Because it was before Crazy World. And it was right after like they played in Moscow and Gorky Park had come out and they had a hand in that.
Yeah.
So
Gorky Park, the Russian...
The Scorpions.
Russian band. They were, the Moscow Music Peace Festival.
Right.
All right, so that's the Scorpions in the 80s. And what should we do? What song should we play to play us out? What should we...
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I know, I could put that 70s version of Believe in Love at the end.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
Yeah. I think it was recorded for In Trance, right? I think that's...
That sounds right.
They just kind of took it and reworked it. I guess they needed a ballad and they couldn't write a good one, so they started going back to that kind of stuff. All right, well, thanks, Joe, for...
Oh, thank you, BJ, for having me back.
With me.
Da 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 da
I'll be back.